Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. You know, when baggage handlers cracked the neck of his guitar, which he had been playing for over 20 years, he re-glued the instrument and began thinking about buying a new one. That's Tim Brooks. And shopping for a guitar for his 50th birthday, he was confronted by a much greater variety of instruments than he'd ever imagined, none of which were just right. He learned about a growing custom-made guitar industry, found a luthier, contracted for a guitar, and began to write this story. It's an amazing story, and Tim Brooks is the man who wrote it. He's a musician, radio commentator, and teaches at the University of Vermont, the author of four books, including Guitar and American Life. It's published by Grove Press. And Tim, thanks for spending time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
We just finished talking with Ben Sidran about the music scene, the jazz music scene in Europe. Did you happen to hear what he said, and would you agree with him?
I caught the last few minutes, and yes, it's really true. There's one of the things that actually played into the rise of the guitar in this country was the fact that in Europe, especially in Britain, there's this sense that people like to be more committed and more knowledgeable and sort of more fanatic about certain specialties over there. And so consequently, there were people in the mid-50s who actually knew more about American blues than most Americans did. And that was certainly also true of jazz as well.
Mm-hmm.
But more particularly true of blues because there was just such so much more of a kind of a racial barrier in this country. And so when the first American bluesmen, especially the black guys, first went over to England and to some extent a couple of other countries, including Germany, they were astounded. There's a great story of one of them, I think it was Brownie McGee, getting off the boat in Southampton. And there's a whole crowd of people there cheering. And he's looking around going, you know, where's the celebrity? And they say, no, we're here for you. And these were people who were blues fans who had been collecting these very, very few records that were coming across the Atlantic, you know, sort of as specialty items or sent by one person to a friend or relative in the UK. And they had founded, you know, blues clubs and jazz clubs. And they were sort of an odd bunch in some respects because on one hand, they were very, very knowledgeable. They're tremendous promoters of blues and jazz and therefore of the music that we, you know, that came to influence the whole kind of blues boom and electric blues boom of the 60s. But they were also sort of insufferable because they were the kind of people who, unless you played it note for note identical to the original, you know, they didn't want to have anything to do with you.
Right. Tell me about your growing up and you picking up the guitar. Were you listening to blues or were you listening to English folk or what were your influences?
Yeah, and again, one of the things that I love about these stories is that everything that people tell you about the 60s is not really true. And the truth is always kind of more interesting and less flattering. I was at the equivalent of high school in England in 67, 68, 69, 70, 71. And I was sort of a little square, really. I had an elder brother who was into some of the things that to us are really avant-garde, like Hendrix and Jefferson Airplane and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to hear a little bit of it, but I wasn't playing guitar then, really. And the first, I didn't actually start playing guitar until I was 17, and I tell you, I was really square. At that point, I had started listening to English folk music because I went to the local folk club, and, you know, you could drink beer and sit at the back and sing, you know, kind of rousing songs, some of which are kind of dirty, and, you know, it was sort of a very appealing scene. It was very different for the American folk music scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I first started playing. But when I went away to college, the first stuff that I started playing that was really at all complicated was actually Paul Simon. The whole Simon and Garfunkel fingerstyle guitar stuff that was coming out. And I talked to Alex Degrassi, by the way, the great guitarist, acoustic guitarist from California, and he said at exactly the same time he was doing exactly the same thing. And in the same month, he came to Europe and began busking on the streets of Paris playing Simon and Garfunkel. And I flew to America and began hitchhiking around the United States with a guitar playing Simon and Garfunkel.
Our guest is Tim Brooks, and if you'd like to join the conversation, if you love guitar, this is a great book, Guitar in American Life, published by Grove Press. He gives you, alternates history with a running account of Rick Davis building a guitar for him, and we'll be talking more about that as the program goes on. Both narratives are very fascinating. Tim goes back to ancient times and leads you through European string history before describing several centuries of American guitar history. Every aspect of the guitar is covered, including performance, musical movements, recordings, innovations in design, manufacturing, sales, and a sense of social history that goes along with it.
I did all that?
You did all that.
Okay, good.
I swear, that's what I got out of it anyway. You may not have been aware of it, but it's a wonderful book. The process of building the guitar is painstaking. It's torturous, and you wonder how the thing ever holds together, and why frequent tuning is required is explained in great detail there. You'll understand the dynamics of the guitar when you finish reading this book. Tim, we're going to catch up with the latest news from National Public Radio. We'll come back. We'll take calls from listeners after that. And if you want to find out more about Tim during the news, you can go to your website. You have a website, don't you?
It's sort of down at the moment, but we can talk about that later. I don't want to hold up the news here.
All right. So we'll come back after the news. Hello, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along today as we've been talking about music. And our guest is Tim Brooks. He is a musician, an NPR radio commentator, teaches at the University of Vermont, and is the author of four books, including Guitar and American Life, published by Grove Press. And in the introduction to the book, Tim recounts what happened when he opened his guitar case and found that something had happened to his guitar. You must remember that and probably still have nightmares about that, Tim.
Yes, it's really every guitarist's nightmare that you open the case, and the case has been on a plane, I shouldn't add, and every guitarist has stories about, you know, taking guitars on a plane and how you try and keep them safe. And in my case, the head of the guitar had almost completely been snapped off. There was a crack that was running so far up through the neck that when I tried to, to string it up, the neck actually kind of wobbled because it was so cracked, and I was just sitting on the living room floor, and I was a broken man because this was the guitar that I had had for 22 years, I think, at that point, and it had really been my constant companion. During that time, I had been married three times. I had had countless jobs. I had left England and I had moved to the United States. And a lot of guitarists feel this way. It's more than just an instrument. And that was really one of the things that I wanted to write about, was what is it about this instrument that makes people have such an intimate relationship with it and makes it mean so much to the owner?
Well, in your research, did you come across the crucible of why the guitar is so important to a guitarist?
Well, it's a whole bunch of reasons, really. As with most things, there's no one simple answer. I mean, one is that it's a portable instrument. You know, you can carry it around with you. You can't, you know, hitchhike to a gig with a grand piano. Another is that it's shaped to be embraced. You know, when you play it, you wrap your body around it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I had a woman, luthier, that is, guitar maker, give me this wonderful description of the first guitar she ever had, that when she played it, she could feel the vibrations of the sound going through the back of the guitar into her diaphragm. You know, that's how intimate it is. But then there's also a lot of other things. I mean, one thing, for example, is that the guitar is not part of the conventional, or until very, very recently, and this is what one of your previous callers, your guest was talking about, the guitar wasn't part of the curriculum. So if you played the guitar, it was because you wanted to, and it was because you didn't want to be in, you know, band, or you didn't want to be a sort of a straight ahead kind of character. And so it really was, it had that kind of outlaw quality, and consequently people tended to be very self-taught. No one was standing over them saying, no, you mustn't play it that way, you've got to play it this way, you've got to sit upright, etc., etc. So all of those things really make it an instrument that is a really a very, very personal thing. And then along with that, partly because, sort of almost by accident, when the great American orchestras at the end of the 19th century started being founded, the guitar was not part of the classical orchestra. What that meant was that the classical orchestra pretty much was fixed at that point. The instruments were what they were, whereas more folk-type instruments, such as the guitar and the banjo and the mandolin, were really much more open to being tinkered with. And so you have far more different kinds of guitar being invented or tried out than any other kind of instrument.
In your search for a guitar builder, after your wife generously offered to buy you a new guitar for your 50th birthday, you found a growing field of custom-made guitar makers, and even there in Vermont.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, pretty much in every state now, there are people who make guitars by hand. And it's almost like the kind of the gourmet food movement, which, you know, takes the notion that not all food should be made by General Mills, you know, and says, yes, you know, once upon a time this stuff was all done by hand. Let's see if we can't go in that direction again. And so I was lucky enough to find a master guitar maker who lived literally 20 minutes away from me. And so I went and saw him. I saw his workshop. I played a number of guitars that he had made. And I said, yeah, let's do this. I should point out two things, by the way. First of all, when my wife said that she would buy me a guitar for my 50th birthday, we had absolutely no money. And part of this was like, if you buy a guitar and write about it, it therefore becomes a business expense. And the other thing is, I'm not actually at the University of Vermont. I was there for a number of years, but now I'm the director of the writing program at Champlain College, also in Burlington, Vermont. I just thought I'd throw that one in.
Very good. And if people would like to actually see the workshop that Rick Davis has at Running Dog Guitars, they can just go to runningdogguitars.com.
Yes,
and they can take a tour of the shop.
That's right. In fact, he has actually just moved to Seattle. He's just starting up a luthery school there. So this is another sign that, you know, that it's catching on, that he's moved to Seattle and he's starting up a school for guitar makers.
And you point out the difference between a guitar maker and a luthier is blank. You fill in the blank.
Yes. Well, I think we have to factor in inflation. In the book, I say a luthier is a guitar maker who charges more than $1,000 per instrument, but it's now more like $2,000. But no, Rick was a very down to earth character and had no truck with that kind of stuff. As far as he was concerned, you know, he was a guitar maker. But yes, there's a lot of people now who are in luthery, as it is called, and this is actually now often referred to as the golden age of guitar making, because there are more people making more really superb quality guitars than at any time in the past.
Are these people who have gone through the major companies, the guilds, the Martins, and are working now on their own, or are these people who, as you ran across them, are totally separate and independent of any major guitar manufacturer?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Really, both. There are many of the very top people, of course, have had years of experience working for guitar companies that, you know, other people have heard of. But then again, a lot of people come from other backgrounds, either from carpentry, cabinetry, metalwork, engineering. There are a number of people who are, for example, former aerospace engineers, that kind of thing. So they have a very, very acute sense of tolerances, because, you know, if you're used to milling metal to, you know, tolerances of a millionth of an inch, then a guitar is pretty easy.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join this conversation of questions about guitars and their role in culture and society, then in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Tim Brooks about his book, Guitar and American Life, it's published by Grove Press. I ran across it in the library in Madison quite by accident, and took it home and just really couldn't put it down because there's so much that is inside about players and styles and how important even something like Hawaii was and Hawaiian guitar music. That definitely had a place in the development of guitar over the years.
Well, yes, and the thing that I think sets the book apart from other kind of histories is that I was really not interested in just a kind of this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And I wasn't interested really in a whole lot of either technological history or brand history. In other words, you know, Fender split off from so-and-so kind of thing. What I was interested in was, as you said earlier, a social history. In other words, why did it become popular? What was it that people liked about it? What role did the guitar play in people's lives that other instruments didn't? And the Hawaiian thing that you mentioned is, yes, that's the sort of the forgotten guitar boom. It was the first and, in some respects, actually the biggest, or certainly one of the two biggest guitar booms. And it began partly by the most bizarre chance imaginable, which was that, in Hawaii, there were probably guitars as early as the 1830s that had been taken over there by Spaniards who had been hired to set up cattle herds.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about a Spanish guitar is that, especially if you have gut strings on it, as virtually all Spanish guitars did in those days, it would have been a very quiet instrument, and it also doesn't have much sustain, and that becomes very important in just a second. During the Civil War, this remarkable thing happened where the Confederate Navy bought a ship in Scotland, sailed it the wrong way around the world so it could sneak into the Pacific Ocean as a gunboat, and it pursued the Northern Whaling Fleet. And every time it found a whale ship, it would either put the crew ashore or sink it or whatever. And the whole idea was that by cutting off the whale oil supply, the industrial machine of the North would grind to a halt, which is sort of a fascinating and far-sighted view.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that, of course, in all whale ships in those days, there were one or two people who were Portuguese, often from the Canary Islands or the Cape Verde Islands, because the Portuguese were really the world's great sailors. And everywhere the Portuguese went, they took instruments with them, especially small instruments, and especially, and this is important, steel-stringed instruments or wire-stringed instruments. And it so happened that one of these ships was run aground or sunk right on the coast of Hawaii. And when the sailors struggled ashore, one of them, or more, was Portuguese, and they had these instruments with steel strings. And the Hawaiians had never heard anything like this, and they caught on immediately because they were quite a lot louder than Spanish gut string guitars. And then later, when Joseph Kukuku, who is this schoolboy, experiments with taking a railroad bolt and sliding it up and down the neck of the guitar, because they're steel strings, he produces the effect that we now recognize as a slide guitar or dobro guitar or steel guitar effect. And that becomes immensely popular, so popular that by 1916, Hawaiian music is the most popular music in America. And everyone is either importing Hawaiians to play, or they're imitating Hawaiians and they're pretending to be Hawaiians. And the reason why country music has pedal steel guitar is because many country bands, which was one of the most popular forms of music in the, say, the 20s and 30s, they also doubled as Hawaiian bands because that was even more popular. And so you'd have the one band that on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday would be, let's say, the Kentucky Serenaders or whatever. On Thursday, Friday, Saturday, they'd be the Honolulu Serenaders. You know, they'd dress up differently, and they would have somebody who had learned how to play a guitar across his lap with a steel. And that's how the steel guitar sound became part of country music.
Well, 90 years ago, Wisconsin Public Radio's first station, WHA, went on the air in 1917, and the first programming was Hawaiian music.
Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. In fact, one of the reasons why the guitar started to become popular around that time was because Hawaiian music was not only popular, but it was very easy to broadcast because basically you just needed two guys, both of whom typically play guitars. One would play a rhythm guitar style or possibly Hawaiian slack key guitar style, and the other would play this steel guitar style. And that was not only immensely popular, but you could program it very easily. And if, for example, you had, some big orchestra from New York playing from 9 until 10:46, then you could have a couple of local guys come in and play a couple of Hawaiian numbers between 9:46 and 10 o'clock. And you find this kind of thing happening all over the place.
Let's take some phone calls. Our guest is Tim Brooks. He's the author of Guitar and American Life. And let's go to John in Brookfield next. Hi, John.
Hi. I would just like to chime in and just say that had it not been for the guitar that I received on my eighth birthday, I'm 38 now. I got a guitar on my eighth birthday. I believe I would be a completely different person and not have seen and done the things that I have done with the help of my guitar. It has really given me a voice. You know, in my teenage years, it helped me get my angst out through the punk rock and, you know, heavy metal stuff. And, you know, when I lost my father, the blues were there for me. And it's really kind of given me a secondary voice.
So what is the voice at 38 now? Is it country? Is it rock? Is it combination?
The voice at 38 now is I just did a reunion with a band that I was in 10 years ago, 2 days before Christmas, and we all kind of got together and played some of the old rock songs, and I figured out that I might be getting older, but I can still rock, you know? and I'm also, now it's kind of like a teaching thing, you know? I'm finding the younger guys who are getting into guitar and not so much teaching them the technique, but just telling them, you know, listen to what's inside,
mm-hmm.
you know, play what's inside. And I'll just, you know, I'll come home, and my wife thinks I'm nuts, so I'll just pick up the guitar and start, you know, singing about the pot roast or the cat or, you know, hey, you got something in the corner of your eye, that kind of stuff, you know. It's just...
Does that sound familiar, Tim?
Well, what I was actually thinking was a couple of things. First of all, the fact that punk music existed for our caller to play, or the blues existed for our caller to play, was because the guitar had been available as an instrument at those two particular times for the two particular groups of people who developed those musics. You know, they were guitar-based musics, you know, for a reason. The other thing is that I'm finding exactly what he's saying. It's very interesting. There's a lot of people who are in their teens or even preteens now who are saying, oh, you play guitar, can you teach me? You know, will you show me? And there's a very strong sense of cultural survival. I know quite a few people who play in bands with their sons or with their daughters, for example.
One of the things that he mentioned brought an incident home to me yesterday. I was out for a walk with my new puppy, and I met a friend whose son is in high school and had just gotten a new acoustic bass, and it had the controls on for electronics and for reverb and that kind of thing. He was so excited. I was just, you know, I couldn't have been more pleased in his excitement at having that guitar that he didn't even want to see the puppy. He wanted to go in and get working on the guitar.
Well, I tell you, my wife gave me a new amp for Christmas. It's an amp which has some effects on it. So now I can get some, you know, a little bit of reverb or chorusing or stuff. And I can't wait to just get up there. I have an acoustic guitar, but I play it, you know, through the amp, and it produces such interesting sounds, and it's so rich and varied that it's like having a whole new instrument. And in fact, what I say in the book is that this really was the revolution that was caused by the electric guitar. It wasn't just that It was louder. It was that it now became an infinite number of new instruments because it could produce a wider range of sounds mm-hmm. than any other instrument that had ever existed.
I was only sorry, Tim, that you gave Les Paul a kind of short shrift, I thought. When it comes to the development of the electric guitar,
yes.
No one has had a greater influence on the guitar or on music or on the effects that it takes to produce music today.
That's what Gibson would like you to think.
That's what he told me. I've got tapes of him saying that.
And that's what Les Paul would like you to think, yes. But the fact is, and there's no doubt that he was doing very interesting experiments ahead of virtually anybody else. The point I made in the book is not that he wasn't doing that. It was that they were not the experiments that were followed up on.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he was doing multi-tracking, but the thing that really caused multi-tracking to catch on was Sgt. Pepper. You don't have any substantial experiments in multi-tracking by, you know, major artists or organizations before Sgt. Pepper. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, we can do all of that stuff. And a number of other Les Paul experiments were really very similar. They were innovative and they were interesting, but they didn't have the kind of impact that everyone now says they had. So history has been kind of rewritten backwards.
All right, I'll take your word on that. Dan, in West Bend, let's give you a chance. Hi.
Hello. I just want to say I'm really enjoying this program.
Mm-hmm.
I can vouch for everything that he said, that Tim has said, and that especially what the last caller said, and just the relationship you have with your guitar and the way it kind of gets you through life. I'm 29, so I'm still in that, I guess I'm old, young enough to be in that angst stage. I've been through the punk rock, and I'm on to the heavy metal right now. And my question, actually, I don't know if this is a little bit off topic, but it's been on my mind lately because I just purchased a new guitar. I've been playing a Gibson SG from like the early 60s. And then I also just recently purchased an ESP Viper, which is the same body style as the Gibson SG. And they both have set neck construction. And the question I have is, if I press against the body and bend the neck, I can bring the guitar almost a half step out of tune in either direction. And that's always been a little bit of an irritation to me, especially if I'm, you know, reclining while I play. The neck is bent back, and it, you know, brings the notes sharper. Is that considered undesirable in an instrument?
It's very funny you should say that because it sort of depends on what it is you want to play it with. But one of the things that, again, distinguishes the guitar from other instruments is that that's the kind of thing that people have been doing for decades, possibly centuries, is to say, what noise can I get out of this thing that no one else can get out of it or possibly isn't even intended to get out of it? So the very first acoustic guitar I had was actually a flamenco guitar that had this wicked crack in it. And I discovered that if I put my hand at the bottom of the body, the lower bout, and I kind of wobbled my hand up and down, it produced this kind of wah-wah effect as the crack opened and closed. So what you've got is, you know, you've got a kind of a built-in whammy bar, and the fact is, before the Bigsby, tremolo arm came along, probably people used exactly what you're talking about to get that kind of note bending effect. Now it's obviously a pain if you want to play, precisely, and you might want to go to your guitar repair guy and find out whether you can get the neck reset. But it's sort of fascinating that. This exact property could be seen as both a fault and an asset.
And an asset. Dan, thank you very much for your call. The time has flown, and Tim, I want to thank you for spending time with us today. The author of Guitar and American Life, and it's one that I can highly recommend, and you won't be able to put it down once you start. Thank you, Tim, for being with us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. Take care.
And again, Guitar and American Life is published by Grove Press. Our thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production today. Tomorrow at 11, Mike Hoffer of Hoffer's Tropical Pets in Milwaukee will be discussing care for exotic pets, non-cat, non-dog pets. And then tomorrow at noon, Ian Herbie Hempfel of Australia, the author of The Spice and Herb Bible, will talk to us about how to use spices and herbs in everyday life. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks for listening.